Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. As Carla recovers from her attempted assassination and Tesca tries to settle into his new role as one of the Blessed, we'll take another look at what else is happening on the island of Maipur. Chapter 30.
Good afternoon, brother.
The voice was perfunctory, the free speak thick with a Terrandon accent.
How will you be making the gracious gift today?
We've already given what we could, friend, came the weary, firm reply. I'm sorry, but there's no more to be had here, so you can take my home off your list of stops.
This is a farm. You must have something. Faithful need food, they do.
We're only beginning to plant now that the damp's passed, and we don't grow food here anyway. This is a cane farm.
Cane?
Sugar cane, mostly. Most often used to make rum.
A vile practice. You should grow something else. Something men can eat.
The farmer shrugged.
It's what grows well here. How it's used by them who buy it isn't my concern. If a cup of rum set down before a man, there's no law says he has to drink it, is there?
There was a long silence as the group of pilgrims glared at the farmer. There were five of them, clustered on the long, tree-lined path that led back toward the road running between the abbey and the city of Maipur. The path ended in a closed wooden gate set into a 3-foot-high stone wall running around the farmstead. The farmer and his eldest son were on the other side of that gate.
"Sorry if that upsets your ways, but there's nothing else for you here," the farmer insisted, trying to remain calm. "I've given deer already. Anything else takes food out of my children's mouths."
"Do not speak to me of your children," the spokesman for the pilgrims shouted. "All of us brought loved ones to the abbey for healing. Those that yet live stare starvation in the face. Our need's greater than yours it is."
The farmer's son flushed and was about to shout back, but the farmer turned toward him, gripping his arm tightly and looking into his eyes with a warning expression. His son held his tongue.
"I'm sorry for that, friend," the farmer went on. "I gave what I could already. We'll be glad to make another gift after the harvest, when we've something for you."
He started to turn away from the gate when one of the pilgrims climbed over the stone wall, which had only been built to block animals.
"What are you doing?" the farmer insisted in alarm as two more of them climbed over the wall. "I've already said we've nothing more for you."
"Have a look for ourselves, we will," the spokesman said sternly as the gate was opened for him by one of his fellows.
"No, you won't," shouted the farmer's son, rushing forward and putting his fist in the face of the first man to come over the fence.
Chaos erupted as the farmer tried to restrain his son, then was forced to join the fight to defend him. The two farmers were healthy and well-fed, but were quickly overwhelmed by the five furious, hungry pilgrims.
"Now what?"
one of them asked their leader as cries of alarm came from the farmhouse. The leader looked down at the two battered men groaning on the ground and came to a quick decision.
"Stand in the path of the faithful, they do. No better than bandits on the road."
The other four looked at him, all of them tensing with mingled fear and excitement.
"Treat them as bandits, we will. You two search the barn for supplies or livestock, and bring back a rope. Anyone tries to stop you, they'll get the same as these two."
One of the pilgrims gave him a triumphant nod and turned toward the barn. But an instant later, a stone the size of a man's fist flew out of the trees beyond the wall, hitting him in the back of the head with a loud crack. Senseless, the man fell face first to the ground. As the pilgrims whirled to face this new threat, a second rock flew into their midst, striking another pilgrim in the chest and knocking him down. They squinted in vain toward the dark space beneath the trees, and while they hesitated, a third missile hurtled out of the foliage. The leader saw it coming and raised his arm reflexively, saving the bridge of his nose but shattering his wrist as the rock crashed into him.
"Flee, brethren!"
one of the pilgrims shouted, stooping to pick up the limp body of the fallen man, a fourth rock landing among them as another joined him in the task. As the pilgrims ran through the gate and down the path toward the road, a fifth and then a sixth rock bounced along the ground behind them, hastening their departure. It was not until they were well out of sight that a figure moved in the trees, coming out into the light. He carried two rocks, one in each hand, and the purse at his belt bulged with two more. Looking down the path after the pilgrims for another moment and nodding in satisfaction, he trotted into the farmyard to kneel down next to the two injured men.
"Best be lying still now," he said. "Giacomo no be thinking those white clads be coming back straight away. Dere be time to rest."
He raised his head, hearing a sound coming from the farmhouse.
"You get away from them," the farmer's wife called, brandishing a pitchfork as she walked steadily toward him.
Giacomo set the rocks down on the ground and rose, raising his hands in front of him.
"Giacomo no be seeking trouble, ma'am. He only be hoping for an end to it."
It's all right, Mira," the farmer said, slowly sitting up with a groan. "He saved us."
He turned to his son.
"Geppo, can you hear me?"
"Papa," the youth said through bruised, swollen lips. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be. Can you move?"
"Hurts to breathe."
"Like as not you've cracked a rib, then. Lie still for now."
The farmer looked up at their rescuer.
"Thank you. They would have killed us."
The tall islander nodded.
"Giacomo be hearing murder in their words, be seeing it in their eyes. He no be turning away from such a thing."
He offered a hand to the farmer and gently drew him up to his feet.
"I'm Tico, by the way," the farmer said. "Your name's Giacomo?"
The islander nodded as Tico examined himself, wincing.
"Just bruises for me, seems like."
He looked down the path.
"They'll be back."
"Most like," Giacomo agreed, "but they be having their own wounded to tend, and they needs be finding friends for greater numbers."
"Well, we'll not be here when they return," the farmer said to his wife, who nodded in firm agreement.
The rest of Tico's family had come out of the house now, two more boys and two girls, all between the ages of 6 and 13, staring at Giacomo with tear-soaked eyes.
"It's all right," Tico called to them. "We're all right. But we need to start packing."
"Cousin Paolo's?" his wife asked.
"That was my thought," Tico replied. "Boys, get the horse hitched to the wagon and bring it out here. Then collect the chickens into the smaller cages and bring them out here as well. Girls, help your mother in the house. Empty the pantry. We'll not leave a scrap of food for those bastards when they return."
As Tico's family sprang into motion, the farmer turned to Giacomo.
"You're welcome to come with us, friend." "Who be this cousin Paolo?"
"My wife's cousin, a good man. He runs the largest farm around here, with enough farmhands to hold off a score of those pilgrims, and he can get the word down to the city and out to the other farms about this. If the pilgrims have turned to hanging those that cross them, then everyone needs to know it."
Giacomo nodded. "Best you and your family be going there then, but Giacomo needs be going to the abbey." "The abbey? You do know that's where those bastards are coming from, right?"
Giacomo nodded again.
"What brought you to my farm, then?"
Giacomo patted his stomach.
"Hunger. He be leaving my paw quick. No time for supplies."
He grinned at Tico, moving his hand to his purse and patting that next.
"But he be having coin."
"Your money's no good here," Tico promised, "not after saving me and my son. You'll neither thirst nor starve if I can do something about it."
"Giacomo be most grateful."
In the next 10 minutes, Tico's younger sons had brought up the horse and wagon while Mira and the girls began depositing the family's food and valuables on the ground next to it, running back into the house for another armload. Giacomo helped Tico lift his injured son into the wagon. Then he assisted Mira by bringing the heavier and bulkier items out of the house and setting them in the wagon as well.
"That's everything, husband," Mira said, wiping her brow. "Everything that can be easily carried off or eaten."
"It's all we have time for," Tico sighed. "The boys are still gathering up the chickens, and the cow can follow the wagon on a lead. Giacomo, eat and drink your fill of what we have here. The wagon's going to be overfilled as it is. I don't mind lightening the load by at least one bellyful before we start out."
Giacomo picked out some dried meats, a loaf of bread, and some fruit, and sat down to eat as Mira and the girls began to load the wagon with the other foodstuffs. Tico gingerly knelt down next to Giacomo, wincing.
You sure you have to go up there?
Giacomo nodded, chewing.
Friends be there, in danger. Giacomo be going to help them best he can.
Tico shrugged.
It's your affair.
Be you familiar with the lands around the abbey?
I've been up there quite a few times, actually. Most folk around here have at least once or twice. The monks produce most everything they need themselves, but every year there might be something they're short of, and they pay more than the merchants down in Maipur. So the folk close by always travel up there just before the harvest starts to see what the monks might have need of. It's become something of a tradition, actually. We go up and the monks come outside, them as study crops and plants at any rate. We share news, open some kegs of beer and mead, and make deals. After the harvest, those who made the deals travel back up there to deliver the goods.
He sighed, shaking his head.
Been going up there since I was a lad, younger than Jeppo, first with my father, then on my own. Don't suppose any of us will bother going up there this year, not with that lot camped at the farm.
He snorted in contempt.
Like as not they just take anything we bring and pay us in salvation.
Giacomo nodded, clearing a space in the dirt with one hand.
Giacomo be curious about the abbey grounds.
And Tico realized what Giacomo was asking. Picking up a twig, he began to sketch.
The land here rises toward the plateau. The abbey's in the middle of that, built on this slope of rock. Outside the walls, near the front gate, there's an old farmstead here. The monks no be using it themselves.
They did once. In the past, there were enough of them that they farmed the fields outside the abbey. But these days, they don't need to anymore. Not so many of them, I suppose. Now, I hear the pilgrims have taken the farm over, and they're starting to clear the fields for planting themselves.
He shook his head.
Most of the plateau's drier than the lands down here, but around the abbey? Now, that's good land, been fallow for years. They'll get good crops, more's the pity. Then we'll never get rid of them.
The islander nodded.
Be you ever inside the abbey?
The lowest part, yes. When I've something to sell, they open the gate to let me in.
He drew two long lines inside the rough outline he'd made for the abbey's outside walls.
They've built two big walls inside, running right across, with gates set in each one. A real fortress. Don't know anyone beyond the monks and the visiting scholars who've gone past that first interior gate. Their church is here somewhere, in the middle, and I think over here's where they live, and beyond that, past the second wall, there's some big building. Biggest thing I've seen built by man. You know the Daughter's Mercy in Maipur.
Giacomo nodded.
Very pretty church, very large.
This is bigger. Apparently, that's where the monks keep all their books.
Giacomo chuckled.
They be putting their books behind two walls, but their church behind only one?
Tico paused.
I've never thought of it like that before. Well, mayhap Giacomo be finding a monk himself to be asking.
He stood up, stretching his long arms above his head and groaning as Mira came forward, holding a large canvas pack stuffed with food.
To keep you going on your road, she said, pressing the pack into Giacomo's hands. No, Tico's right, she added as Giacomo reached for his purse. This is nothing compared to what you've already done for us.
Tico nodded in agreement as he got to his feet, dragging one foot over the map of the abbey to erase it.
Everything aboard, mother? He asked his wife.
All but the chickens, Mira told him. Giacomo, do you think you could...
The children burst into laughter as Giacomo set down the pack and gave her a courtly bow, his arms flourishing wildly, before hoisting the cages and their flustered occupants into the wagon.
I'm sorry you're not coming with us, friend, Tico said, but I'll wish you all the luck in the world, since you're likely heading into trouble. Hopefully you can find your friends quickly.
Giacomo smiled.
One friend at least, Giacomo no be having trouble finding.
He closed his eyes, calculating Tesca's distance and direction from him. Everything had changed 2 days ago. The connection to Tesca had been fading, becoming so weak at times that Giacomo had to stop and concentrate for several minutes to find it again. That night, as had been his habit, Giacomo had climbed into a tree and slept in the branches, the swaying and creaking of the limbs as close as he could get to the rocking of a ship. His sleep had been fitful, full of odd dreams. Tiny stone figures bathed in a soft blue light, and he was forced awake repeatedly by twinges of phantom pain in his belly. Then suddenly, in the middle of the night, he'd bolted upright, nearly falling out of the tree. Something had happened at the other end of the connection. Tesca had been dying, but all of a sudden, he wasn't. His presence blazed across Giacomo's mind, bright as a bonfire at midnight, and around that presence, Giacomo could feel the winds rustling and swirling. They might not be speaking to him any longer, but just being able to sense them at all had brought him a sense of peace and confidence he'd not felt since the battle with the Lee Rouge. But there was still cause for concern. Giacomo could sense that Tesca was uneasy, constantly on guard. He might have been drawn back from death's door, but there was no shortage of enemies who wouldn't mind another chance to push him through it for good. The Thanes were heading to the Abbey as well, probably were already there. And Giacomo hadn't liked the look of these pilgrims when he first saw them outside Maipur. This encounter at Tico's farm had only confirmed his fears.
"De other friend, most like she be at his side."
He was about to get down from the wagon when he paused, taking a closer look at the cages the chickens were in. The bars were made of stalks of cane, smooth and hard. He looked back at Tico and tapped the cage.
"Sugarcane?"
"Not those," Tico said. "We grow mostly sugarcane, but I also grow a stronger cane for furniture and the occasional cage for chickens. The tables and chairs in the house, those are all mine, and what we don't use, I sell."
"To the abbey?"
"Aye, the monks are always in need of more bookshelves, it seems."
He grinned at Giacomo as the islander laughed. "A little extra money, and it keeps me busy during the damp." Giacomo nodded, running a finger along one of the bars.
"You be having any more of this?"
"I've got stock in the barn, which I'd take with me if there was room in the wagon. At least the pilgrims can't eat it." He sighed. "Like as not I'll be using them to make new furniture for the house when we come back, assuming the house is still standing."
Giacomo nodded, thinking. Then, as he stepped down from the wagon, he took a handful of silver coins from his purse.
Tico sighed. "I said your money's no good here." "This no be for food," Giacomo said. "Giacomo needs be hiring you, craftsman. Quick job."
His smile faded as Tico shook his head.
"Please, Tico, where Giacomo be going, money be of no use. Most like men's blood be spilled soon, and that price Giacomo no be sharing with you. This silver be washing your hands clean."
Mira stepped up to Tico and touched his arm.
"Husband, let be."
Her smile was sad as Giacomo pressed the coins into her hand. Tico sighed.
"All right, consider me hired. A quick job, you say. What do you need?"
Giacomo touched the hard cane bars of the chicken cage.
"Rocks be enough against five, but against hundreds, most like Giacomo be needing better."
"Are you sure it's him?"
"Of course I'm sure. I've been keeping an eye on that bastard ever since Ali brought him home from Narlos. I tell you true, never would have happened if Father had just bought her that panther cub she'd wanted when she was 9. Always bringing exotic pets home after that."
"I see. May I take another look?"
"What happened to your spyglass?"
"Cabot took it."
There was a silence.
"Ah."
Ambrose Fane passed the spyglass to his cousin.
"Sicarius is off to the left of the camp, walking around those fields they're working."
Oryk ducked under a hanging branch and peered through the instrument, frowning.
"They're all wearing white. How do you tell them apart?"
"He's taller than a good number of them, for one thing. But he's got a girl at his side. Blonde hair, cut short. That's my cabin boy."
"Cabin boy?"
"Shut up, Oryk."
Oryk kept further comments to himself.
"Ah, there he is. And there's your your former employee. And right next to them is that older man.
Are you sure that, Sidwa?
He's got 6 fingers, he's Malakan, and he's cost me a lot of money and time. That's good enough for me. Maybe I'll just take all his fingers, even him out.
Ambrose gave a low grunt of laughter.
How do you say 2 spoons in Malakan?
I don't know.
Oryk silently watched the pilgrims for a few minutes.
I must say, the left hand looks a lot healthier than when we saw him last.
Aye, Ambrose muttered. I was wondering about that myself. What happened to him?
A miracle, came a third voice directly behind them. Both Fanes jumped, whirling to see Garrick Cabot.
Damn you, Cabot, Ambrose snapped, keeping his voice as low as he could. I told you to stop doing that. Where in the hells have you been?
Scoutin', the smuggler said in his dead voice, his eyes drifting past the Fanes to regard the campsite. They were in a copse of trees some distance from the camp, concealed behind thick foliage.
Will thought it'd be best to learn a bit more about this lot and what they're doing outside the walls.
Oryk did not comment on that, turning back to look at the campsite through the spyglass.
Well, Ambrose demanded, what did you find out?
This lot are on a pilgrimage, Cabot said. They think there's miracles to be had here. Looks like Sicarius got himself one.
Ambrose gave Cabot a dubious scowl.
Are you serious? The Triad healed him?
Cabot shrugged.
That's what this lot believes. I saw my dagger go into him, and when we saw him on the wagon, death wasn't more than a day off.
He pointed toward the camp.
But there he is, walking round. They call him the Blessed now. Him and the 7 or 8 others who've been healed.
How did you learn all this?
They send small groups out and about to find what food they can. So when one group came by, Will and me asked the liveliest of them some questions.
The liveliest? Ambrose asked.
The one who seemed most willing to talk. Will can always spot 'em. Lets me know which throat to cut last.
Oryk suppressed a shudder as Ambrose made a choked gasp.
After all that riding and backtracking you made us do to get up here, evading their patrols, you just take it into your head to kill a few of 'em.
There was questions we needed answering, Cabot said, sounding bored.
And what happens when the bodies are found?
This lot's got no more woodcraft than a drunk sailor. They didn't notice that dead fellow we found on the way up here. They'll not find those others, not where Will and me stashed 'em.
Ambrose sighed.
Fine, fine. Did any of your questions concern that body we found? He had pilgrim's clothes, but there's a graveyard up at the camp. So, who killed him and left him in the woods? Not bandits. They left his pack with him.
Bandits wouldn't hide the body anyway, Cabot said, or they'd hide it better. A grave too shallow to keep animals from digging it up says it was done by folk who didn't want it known, but was short on time, shovels, or both.
So, who'd need to hide the murder of a pilgrim?
Another pilgrim, Oryk commented.
Aye, Ambrose said after a moment. Good one, Oryk. Thinking like that reminds me you're a Fane.
Ignoring Oryk's silent reproach, he crossed his arms, staring at the campsite.
Not so righteous as they pretend to be, then. When was he killed, and how?
Cabot shrugged. Over a month back, near on 2. Hard to tell how, with that much of him chewed off.
Anything in that pack we took, Oryk?
A very battered book of the Triad, Oryk replied, looking through the contents again. An empty water skin, a spare shirt, and this thing. He drew the object out, shaking his head. It was an oblong block of wood, 4 inches across at the wide end, 2 at the other. One side was studded with a collection of round-headed nails. The other had what looked like a pocket of thick leather attached to it at the wide end and several leather straps, some with buckles at the narrow. Ambrose squinted at it.
Looks like a shoe cobbled by a blind man, he snorted.
A shoe? Oryk turned it over a few times. I suppose it does.
He was barefoot when buried, Cabot added, looking at the object himself now.
Well, this certainly wouldn't fit any foot I've ever seen, Oryk commented, and there's only the one. There are some letters carved into the wood. The letter C, followed by test 5.
What does that mean?
No idea, Oryx sighed, dropping the item back into the sack.
Mad, the lot of them,
Ambrose muttered, taking his spyglass back from Oryx.
But somehow Sicarius survived that belly wound, so something's going on.
He studied the camp.
Blast it, the bastard's left the fields. Where did he... Ah, there he is.
What is he doing now? Oryx asked.
He's near the barn, his cousin explained. He and a few of the others look like they want to go inside.
He paused as a slow smile spread across his face.
And he's arguing with a few of those larger fellows, the ones with the quarterstaves.
Fellow he's talking to, Cabot said, Oryx's spyglass now lifted to his eye. He's the leader of that group we met on the road.
So he is.
There was a long silence. Then Ambrose chuckled.
Ha! Look at the way he's standing. Plain to see he don't like Sicarius much. Bastard can't take a step without getting under someone's skin.
What's happening now? Oryx asked, squinting toward the camp.
Our fellow with the staff is... backing down, Ambrose said. They're letting Sicarius and his friends go into the barn.
He sighed.
That's a shame. Would I like to see him and his boys put those staves to good use?
If they think Sicarius is holy, maybe they don't dare, Oryx ventured.
Aye, Ambrose replied. That's another good thought you've had.
He lowered the spyglass, smiling and thinking.
You remember back on the road how their leader... Oh, what was his name?
Donal, Cabot said. The others called him Donal.
Right, Donal. He was asking questions about who Sicarius was, wasn't he? Like, he didn't believe whatever story those three had spun for him. A man seeking the truth.
His smile widened to a grin, his golden tooth glinting in the afternoon light.
Wonder how much he'd pay to learn that truth.
And how in the hells are we going to get over there and tell it to him?
Oryx demanded.
Not tell, Ambrose corrected. Sell. I'm surprised at you, Oryx. If there's one thing a Fane can spot, it's a customer.
Oh, maybe I would have if I had my spyglass back, Oryx fumed.
Cabot made a single laugh, almost a grunt.
Sans wrath, Ambrose. Those people nearly killed us. They left all five of the men I hired swinging from the trees.
What's the problem? You only paid them half at the start of the job, right? So, you're less out of pocket than you planned.
Oryx wiped a hand across his sweating brow.
The problem is that there's over 10 times as many pilgrims out there than in that caravan. They're not going to let 3 outsiders just walk in, especially when they recognize us. So whatever you've got in mind, you can count me...
He was interrupted as Garrick Cabot dumped a pile of filthy clothes on his head. They were once white, now stained to an uneven pale brown.
Put these on, the smuggler said.
Where did you...
Will thought they might be useful, seeing as their owners had no further need.
Oryx sputtered furiously as he flung the clothes away.
I thought the smell was coming from you, Cabot.
He paled, wiping at a wet stain on his shirt.
And they have fresh blood on them.
Rub some dirt into it. Won't look no different than the other stains once they dry, the smuggler replied.
He took the rest of the clothes from his pack and tossed some at Ambrose. Then he stopped, looking annoyed.
Damn, we've only enough for 3. What's Will gonna wear?
Ambrose and Oryx shared a look, then Ambrose cleared his throat.
Well, Cabot, he said slowly, perhaps your brother should stay here and guard the horses.
Stay here, Cabot said.
He turned his head, looking at someone only he could see, and nodded.
You're right, Will. Never split up.
He looked back at Ambrose.
Will's coming with us.
Ambrose scowled, but Oryx interrupted, thinking fast.
You know, he offered, I think that Will's good enough at disguise that he won't need his own set of clothes, don't you? None of the pilgrims will take the slightest notice of him.
Cabot considered this.
Aye, fair point. Nobody sees Will unless he wants him to.
He stripped his clothes off with quick efficiency and no modesty, pulling one of the tunics over his head, then hoisting up one set of pants. His disguise complete in less than a minute, Cabot looked out at the camp again.
They've a few patrols about. Probably best to wait until dark. Will and me'll circle about, find the best way to get in close. Get changed. Stay here.
And before Ambrose or Oryk could object, the smuggler was gone, melting into the trees.
This is madness, Ambrose, Oryk said after waiting a full minute to make sure Cabot was really gone. We could have gone back to Maipur and gotten some more men before coming up here. Or I could have stayed in Maipur and put together a little reception for them when they come back down from the abbey.
Look at that lot out there, Oryk. They're not going to be intimidated by anything less than a small army, and our pockets aren't deep enough for that. And waiting in Maipur is no good either. The old spider's taught Sicarius too well. He'll pull a trick and slip around you while you're looking in the wrong direction. I've learned the hard way that once you know where Sicarius is, you keep him in sight as best you can. So we stay close, watch, and wait.
They settled into an impatient silence, Ambrose continuing to study the camp through his spyglass, Oryk half-heartedly rubbing dirt and leaves into the filthy clothes he was now wearing to disguise the bloodstains. Then, after a half hour, the light beginning to fade around them, they heard movement in the trees behind them.
About time, Ambrose muttered, turning. Half thought Cabot decided not to come back.
But it was not Garrick Cabot who came through the trees. Instead, it was four tall men in white pilgrim's clothing, carrying quarterstaves. Ambrose and Oryk scrambled to their feet as one of them blinked in surprise.
Aye, you two again.
Know them, Timon?
Asked their leader, an older man with salt and pepper hair and beard.
Aye, Angus, from the road they were, leading that group of slavers.
Oh, aye, said the leader, looking amused. Donal mentioned them, he did. Said he'd a few questions for them.
His gaze dropped to the ground, taking in the piles of clothing the Fanes had been wearing, then rose to study the pale, blood-stained garb they now wore, and the man's amusement melted away.
Seems I've a few questions of my own as well.
An interesting move, Captain.
Merci, my lord.
A variation on one of the cafe openings, is it not?
I thought it might be something you had not seen before.
Not for many years. When I was a young man, I traveled to Surim as part of a diplomatic envoy for my father, and I befriended the vizier who ruled the city on behalf of the Sultan of Shafur. He played chess and was very fond of his people's opening gambits.
Count Valian leaned back in his chair, gazing off into space.
After Predatoris Rex sacked Shafur, the Sultan's fortunes declined, and he was forced to cede Surim to one of his rivals. My friend was recalled to a post far inland, and we lost touch. I wonder what has become of him.
He studied the board for a moment, then made a move.
I believe this was often an excellent counter to several of the Kefi gambits.
We shall see, my lord.
Valian laughed.
And where did you learn to play Kefi openings?
Captain Dutram smiled.
A situation similar to yours. I was given the assignment to escort a diplomatic envoy from Malakai to the court of the Padishah. My ship was docked in Azar al-Kef for 6 weeks, during which time the commander of the city garrison and I invited each other to dinner many times, and we would often play chess after the final course.
Count Valia nodded and reached for his glass of brandy. Dutram took note that while the Lord of Maipur lifted his glass frequently, it was not refilled very often.
He is content to savor the aroma more than the taste. A man of refinement, restraint, and nigh infinite patience.
It was Dutram's third night as a guest in the palazzo, the Count's palace in the city. At dinner on the first night, Dutram described the battle with Sidois to the Count and his assembled guests. He was well versed in the art of telling an exciting tale to jaded nobility, and this was one that needed little embellishment. The Count's wife, Marcilla, his daughter, Violetta, and several of the other guests at dinner were enthralled, gasping in alarm as the captain spoke of the Lee Rouge bearing down on her prey. The Count's son and heir, Dralian, also enjoyed the story, but Dutram saw how the young man glanced to his father repeatedly, taking his cues from the Count's manner. Also in attendance were Major Torrio and his wife. The Major likewise applauded and laughed at all the right moments, but he seemed to hold some part of himself in reserve, his smile never quite reaching his eyes, while his wife looked troubled, especially when Dutram made any mention of Kerla or magic. For there was no way to leave them out of his story entirely. One only had to look at the cutlass to see that something unnatural had happened to her. But Dutram did his best to avoid some details, downplaying the effect of Kerla's magic on the battle, both in repairing the cutlass's sails and unleashing that horrible backlash which nearly sent both ships into the abyss. But his lies were solely those of omission. Not knowing what information Montrose had passed on to the Count, the captain did not want to risk Valian catching him in a deliberate falsehood, so by the end of his tale, he knew that the Count had learned some facts that he had not known before. After dinner, the Count invited Dutram to join him, Drallian, and Major Torrio on the balcony for cigars and brandy. There, the questions had resumed, but delicately. Relations between Maipor and the Kohaya Quad were cordial, and that courtesy extended to treatment of each other's diplomats and military officers. It became clear that Valian wished to learn the full details of the battle that Dutram had sketched out, but he was unwilling to press the issue too aggressively and risk a diplomatic incident with his neighbor Duke Stephen. Instead, the Lord of Maipor invited Dutram to play a game of chess with him, which he won after a protracted middle game, finally pinning Dutram's king in a corner. Afterward, he complimented Dutram on his skill and extended his hospitality for the duration of the cutlass's repairs, and Dutram knew that he wasn't going to be leaving the palazzo for the foreseeable future. Still, his prison was the most comfortable he'd ever found himself in, and his interrogations were conducted over a chessboard, with excellent food and drink at hand. Dutram suspected the Count was aware of his fondness for creature comforts, and sought to wear him down through indulgence, so he followed the Count's example and refilled his glass slowly, keeping his appetite in check and his mind clear. From the Count's questions, Dutram gradually learned that Montrose had told the Maiporians everything Dutram had shared with him earlier. He knew, for example, that Duke Stephen, by a strange twist of fate, now had two left hands, one of them an elf, the other considered by some to be the deadliest blade in the frieze, and both of these agents were now making separate journeys to the Abbey of St. Ravino, pursuing the Duke's business. What surprised Dutram, however, was that Count Valian had made no inquiry into what that business was.
"He already knows," the captain mused. "He has ruled Maipor for nearly 20 years, and the abbey is his closest neighbor. Who else is in a better position to learn such a secret? Or, perhaps, he knows there is no point questioning me about it. Those who convey spies to their destinations rarely know the reasons why."
Instead, Valian's questions circled around the magic-wrought changes to the cutlass, asking again and again in different ways and from different directions about how the ship had been altered, slowly drawing the story out of Dutram in fragments. Major Torrio was always present for such sessions, listening carefully to the Count and the captain's conversation, then abruptly asking a new question, which drew upon the clues Dutram had been forced to reveal. The captain was reminded of removing a stubborn piece of old paint from wood, the Count carefully probing at the edges, loosening pieces here and there. Then suddenly Torrio would pull away a larger fragment with ease. Dutram knew what they were doing, but could do little to stop it, short of refusing to answer any more questions. This, he knew, would only bring an end to his comfortable imprisonment, and the questions would resume, far more directly, in a cell in the lower levels of the palazzo.
"You are certain, Captain, that this spell, as you call it, is not contagious?" Major Torrio asked. "You said that it spread from the cutlass to the Le Rouge. Could it not spread to Maipor?"
"I did not say that it spread, Major," Dutram countered.
One of Torrio's favorite tactics was misquoting Dutram to catch him in a lie.
Rather, the spell moved from the cutlass to the Le Rouge, lured there by Monsieur Sicarius. When our muskets began to misfire again, we knew it had completed its migration, and we were able to cut ourselves loose of the doomed ship before she sank beneath the waves, taking the spell with her.
Yet two of the men that you believed had gone down with that ship suddenly turn up in Maipor on their own? Torrio countered. How do you account for that?
I was unconscious during this final stage of the battle, as I have said, Dutram reminded the major. My officers and crew all swore to me that the Le Rouge sank the moment the cutlass came free, and I have no reason to doubt their word. Nor do I doubt the word of Giacomo, one of those two men who survived. He told me himself that the Le Rouge sank beneath his very feet. Then he and Monsieur Sicarius spent several days adrift at sea on a raft made of collected flotsam, until they were found by the Osprey and brought here. He reached for his own snifter of brandy, inhaled the vapors with satisfaction, and took a small sip.
My lord, he said, looking at Count Valian, I understand your concerns. If I believed that the cutlass was still affected by this magic, I would never have brought her into your harbor. I give you my word on that, as an officer and a gentleman.
And I accept it, the count replied, gesturing for Torrio to cease his questions, which the major did without objection.
Your reputation is beyond reproach, captain, the count went on. The sordid affair which prompted your resignation from the Malaccan Royal Navy is known to me, and I am also aware that those circumstances were not of your own making.
Dutram flushed and looked down at the chessboard.
You have done well for yourself in securing your post with Duke Stephen. If I had been quicker off the mark, you might be wearing my uniform instead of his.
This brought Dutram's head back up, and Valian smiled at the captain's shock.
In any event, we have had sufficient time to verify your story. Each piece of damaged wood that has been replaced on the cutlass has been brought to the palazzo for examination. I have been told that although strange changes have indeed been wrought upon the wood, there is no sign of further transformation.
Merci, my lord.
Valian nodded, swirling his brandy in the glass.
Magic is becoming a factor that cannot be ignored, wouldn't you say? Even here, in the Frieze, to imagine a scene such as you described on your ship happening in the streets of my city...
He broke off, looking grave, taking an actual sip of brandy this time.
And there is the other matter to concern ourselves with as well. You crippled the Le Rouge with a full broadside after this elf, this Kerala, was able to make the cannon fire properly. Major Torrio informs me that sailors from the cutlass have been telling their own tales of the battle, as sailors are wont to do, but however the tales vary, upon that one part they all agree.
What has been done once can be done again, said Major Torrio.
Dutram nodded. He had been wondering when the conversation would reach this point.
The effort of it nearly killed her, Major, and the price we paid for that success was the loss of over a dozen sailors and the crippling of my ship. It may be that the girl is the only one who can do what she did, he mused. Perhaps that would be best.
That is irrelevant, the Count told him. Now that folk know it can be done, that cannon can fire reliably again. Someone will seek a way to repeat that process. Pirates, generals, sovereigns, any person who longs for a return to the days of cannon and musket will want to get their hands on an elf and replicate what happened on your ship.
The Frieze will be divided into those who have reliable guns, said Major Torrio, and those who want them. The delicate dance of daggers and shadows that passes for diplomacy here will change, and quickly.
Count Valian sighed.
But the real danger is when the mainland powers learn of this. Let us say, Captain, that Malachi is the first to regain the use of cannon. You know what Terendor and Alkef's reaction would be.
War, Dutram said soberly.
They could not allow my homeland to keep such a secret to herself, and they would move against her before she could bring that new power to bear upon them.
A war such as that, the Count said, would spread into the Freeze. One way or another, in time, each of our realms would be dragged into it. Mine, the Duke's, the Baron's.
Valian gave a tired, bitter laugh.
And if the Sabrians were to find it first, Triad help us all.
There was a knock at the door, then Dralian came in, holding something very small in his hand.
Father, he said, presenting a small strip of paper, coiled into a tight roll, one of the abbot's birds has brought a message.
He glanced at a small table in the corner of the room, where another chessboard was set up, the pieces arranged in the middle of a game.
Perhaps he's found a way to defend his rook.
We shall see, the Count replied, relieved to change the subject.
He unrolled the message and read it, his expression turning first quizzical, then thoughtful.
What is it, Father?
See for yourself, the Count groaned, holding the note out for his son. It's his move, but not on the board I'd expected. He says that tensions continue to escalate with those damn pilgrims, and that he may soon have to evict them from Abbey lands.
Can he do that? Dralian asked, surprised.
Valian shrugged.
He has the authority to order it, but I doubt he has the power to enforce it. There must be over 300 of them camped outside his gates by now.
Dralian frowned.
But why did he contact us? Surely this is an ecclesiastical matter.
It is, and I've no doubt one of Walter's birds is on its way to the citadel as well, but the hierarchs won't respond to this matter in haste. That Fletcher woman is a decorated sword commander, a damned hero in Eastern Terrandor. The Hierarch of the Sun won't be willing to act without hearing her side of the story first. It will be weeks at the very least before they could get someone down here to conduct an investigation, and all that time, those fanatics will still be up there, getting angrier.
He sighed and glanced at Dutrom.
Have you heard about these pilgrims?
Some, my lord. You had already barred them from the city by the time we arrived, so I have not seen any myself. Many have spoken of it, though I had not heard there is a sword commander among them.
Indeed, the Count replied. Bishop Lorea brought her to me as a courtesy when the commander presented herself and her squad at the cathedral.
And this woman is a pilgrim?
Not when she left the city, but sometime after reaching the abbey, she and her men apparently put on the white. There weren't too many pilgrims up there when she first arrived, but a lot more started coming after that, most of them from Eastern Terrandor, following in her wake, and she started organizing them, setting up regular trips down from the abbey and back to escort the new arrivals. Her men drove off the bandits that had been plaguing the road, which sounded encouraging, until I found that they were hanging anyone they captured and leaving their bodies to swing from roadside trees as an example to others. Then her people began to seek charity.
The gracious gift, Dutrom replied. Your merchants were quick to share those stories, my lord. That was when you barred them from the city?
Yes, but before long, bands of them started traveling to the farms and villages along the road, making similar requests. They're not begging for food so much as requisitioning it. I asked the abbot to put a stop to that, and I'm getting fewer reports of such things, but if he evicts them from abbey lands, that will change.
That is why the abbot is asking for your help, Dutrom offered. What you have been describing, my lord, sounds like a powder keg sitting perilously close to the flames. Neither you nor the abbot can afford to wait for the hierarchs to respond.
Valian gave Dutrom a wry smile.
And how, captain, do you think I should respond? Even with the abbot's invitation, this is an ecclesiastical matter. Did you know that the last Count of Maipur, who tried to influence affairs at San Ravino, came within a hair's breadth of excommunication? It was over 100 years ago, but the hierarchs have not forgotten.
Dutrom's gaze roamed over the table as he groped for an answer.
but a moment later he paused, staring down at the chessboard.
Captain?
Raising his head, Dutron met the Count's eye.
My lord, with your permission, there is something in your city that may be of use to you in this matter, something that your predecessor did not have 100 years ago.
Oh, and what is that?
Dutron smiled as he perused the 2 matching pieces in his back row that flanked his king and queen. Selecting one of them, he brought it into play with a diagonal slide across 3 squares.
Your move, my lord.
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the frieze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.